two of my brothers and myself was offered to learn in the yeshiva called Itri, which some of you may have heard of. Tavshim Amad Aleph was back a few years, and I personally was offered to hear a shir on Perek Lulav HaGozel from Harav Nosson Kamenetsky, our speaker this evening. And there's no question that Hagon Rav Kamenetsky, who was one of the Miyaskim, one of the founders of that yeshiva, was certainly instrumental in creating a rather fertile environment for many youth who came to Eretz Yisrael at that time. And unquestionably, it's one of the first of the yeshivas, which of course has spawned the whole generation of many American yeshivas today that, Baruch Hashem, are quite popular. Many years ago, I heard from my Rebbe Yerach Soloveitchik, Zichron Livracha, there are two genres of masorah. There's a masorah which he called a masorah of shmiya, a person who listens to shiurim and is zochah to hear Dibrei Torah from rabbeim, who themselves were zochah to hear Torah from their rabbeim, midor ledor. The masorah of Moshe Kibbutz Torah Sinai, the masorah of Yeshua, Yeshua of Iskenen, the Chulu. But then there's a second masorah that he described as a masorah of Re'iya. That masorah, he said, is exemplified in Pirkei Avos. Who are your Omer? Margul of the Pumne. But that masorah is primarily founded upon Shimush, what the Gemara says in Brachas, Gedolah Shimush Shel Torah Yosef Limuda, Elisha Hanavi, Eliyahu, his Rebbe, Asher Yasak Mayim Al Yodo. That's a totally different masorah, one which in many respects is preeminent and certainly is a prerequisite for leadership. Chazal comment in the context of the Ribbono Shel Olam looking for a successor to Moshe Rabbeinu, the Parsha in Pinchas, Yivkar Hashem Elokei Aruchos L'chol Basa Isha La'edo, Asher Yetzi Lefneim, Asher Yavu Lefneim, Asher Yotziem, Asher Yudiem, V'lofsi Adas Hashem Katzon Asher Elohem Goel. And the Medrash Rabbah points out over there that the one, of course, who succeeded Moshe Rabbeinu is Yeshua Ben Nun, but primarily succeeded Moshe Rabbeinu because he was the Shamesh Moshe Rabbeinu. Well, Yomish Yitofa Oel, the Torah says. And the Medrash called to Pasuk, Nosa Te'ena Yochal Pirya, that he was the one that was responsible for literally setting up the Beis Medrash before the Shir, Paras at the Machzalot, Sider Basaf Salim, that's how the Medrash formulated. As a result of that, he became the Man of Yisrael. Soloveitchik was very fond of quoting in the Hakdama to the Rambam and Mishnah Torah, and based on the Medrash over there as well, the Medrash says there were individuals that were Yotzer Mimulachim, the Yeshua Ben Nun, that intellectually were more acute than Yeshua, Elazar of Pinchas. But the Rambam writes, "Will Yeshua, Shul Talmid Shem Moshe Rabbeinu, Masa Torah Shem Alpeh Vitzivor Aleh?" Because of his shimush, because of that ability to be Mishamesh, Moshe Rabbeinu, he was zochah to become the Man of Yisrael. Rav Kamenetsky clearly has both of these two genres of Masorah, both the Masorah of Shemiyah and the Masorah of Re'iyah. He was zochah in his own right to be a Magid Shir for many, many years, and obviously grew up in the house of one of the Gedolei Hador, Agon of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal. If any Masorah is missing today, it's certainly that second Masorah. It almost is non-existent, and probably many of the problems that we have is Maneinu Anu, I would say it could be traced to the fact that we're lacking in that Masorah. We have a Masorah of Shmiyah, and want to say that Pshuto Kamashmo, today, given the technology that's available, people hearing Shurim all day, all night, Baruch Hashem, Ken Yirbu, but Mitzat Sheni, the second Masorah of Shimush, is almost totally lacking. And that has spawned also many, many problems and problematica in our generation that are mind-boggling. And therefore, when I heard already a number of years ago that the Sefer, as I call it, The Making of a Gadol, was going to be published, I was very excited. And as I mentioned last night, to me, that Sefer is one of the most remarkable stories that have been published in the last 50 years of this genre. And I feel personally indebted to Rav Kamenetsky and hope, Yitz Hashem, that will continue to publish the remaining volumes, so we can actually get full insight into his father, Hagaon Rav Kamenetsky, and many other Gedolim of the previous generation who came into contact with Hagaon Rav Kamenetsky. I want to be Makir Tov this evening to Jeff Rachwager, because It was basically he who spearheaded this entire event this evening, and he actually pushed it from every direction, imaginable and unimaginable. And there's no question, we owe him a really hakaras hatov for the fact that Baruch Hashem tonight we have the great shkus of hearing Harav Nasi Kamenetsky shlita.
Thank you, Rabbi Davis, for your warm introduction. The talk tonight is on the theme of the closing of the Lashon Yeshiva. I'll just describe in a few words what happened on that morning of February 2nd, 1892. Hey Shvat Tov Reish Nun Beis. That morning, the yeshiva building was surrounded by government officials and policemen from the whole county, not only from the city, from the entire county, together with a lot of just going from the surrounding farms. They were afraid that the Jews may stand up against them, so they organized that a lot of going stand around to make sure the Jews don't rebel. And the governor of the area, he went into the yeshiva, and in the presence of all the Rashi Yeshiva and the Talmidim, they read out an order by the Russian government that the yeshiva is to be closed and the Talmidim are to leave within 3 days. They're all supposed to leave the town. And after the Sefer Torahs and the Sfarim were removed, they put a seal on the door, a seal that was a government stamp, that no one should dare enter the building anymore. This was the closing that took place on February 2nd, 1892. My talk tonight is divided into two. One part is about Voloshin as the mother yeshiva, and the second part is the closure itself. The book that Rabbi David mentions, Making of a Gadol, has a lot of material on this. Of course, you know that the book was banned. I don't know if you heard about it. But last Shabbos, I davened in Rabbi Sternberg, Rabbi Moshe Sternberg, he's a dying of the Eidah Haredis, and he reads in the sunlight the other signatories on the ban, because he didn't sign against the book. And I got an aliyah there, and they gave me shlishi, and I walked over to give him a yashakala. So he tells me which page he's up to. And after davening, he tells me, that how do I know that the Kohen of a Hasidim said this and that about the Yisrael Salantan? So I said, read the book. It says my father told me this. So how do your father know about Kohen of a Hasidim when you're mismagdic? Anyways, he is reading the book very, very carefully, very meticulously. As a matter of fact, he tells someone that he spent the whole of Shana Rabba night reading maybe the Magadha. That was his tikkun. Anyways, in order to please everyone, I published, this is the cover of it, Making of a Gadol, Improved Edition. Unfortunately, it's not improved, it's only improved. Actually, what I will speak about tonight is found in various parts of my unimproved book and of my improved book. But like a Dvar Torah, there's a Gemara in the beginning of Chagiga that Rabbi Yeshua said, he asked two Talmidim of the Yeshiva of Yavne, Rabbi Yechanan and Breiko, Rabbi Lozoch Chisma, he asked them what was said in the Bais Medrash this past Shabbos. So they said, we want to hear better what you have to say, as if there's nothing, no chiddush there. So Rabbi Yeshua said, no. E efshel Bais Medrash v'loy chiddush. And the smedrish has to have a chiddush. It's impossible. Similarly, when I was preparing to speak to you tonight, even though it's something that I wrote about in Malay, but efshel Bais Medrash v'loy chiddush. So my talk tonight won't be completely found in the making of a gadol. Everyone knows that the Velozhin Yeshiva was a mother yeshiva. What does that mean? It means that it was the yeshiva which, the first yeshiva that opened after many years when there were no yeshivas in Lithuania. Of course, there was a lot of Torah, and people learned in the shtiblach and the towns and so on, but a yeshiva, a center which would attract, and students would come from all over, with its own administration and its own Rosh Yeshiva, was something new, and it was opened by the Rav of the Lozhin, Reb Chaim Volozhiner. Reb Chaim Volozhiner was the, we call him Reb Chaim Volozhiner, he's actually called Reb Chaim Yitzchakim. His father was Yitzchak, but he's known as Reb Chaim of the Lozhin, where he was loved. He was the prime talmid of the Vilna Gaon, and he opened the yeshiva in 1802, just over 200 years ago. This is the accepted year of the yeshiva's opening, although in official Russian government papers pertaining to its closure 90 years later, the government papers refer to the date of its opening as 1805. Now the book, the comprehensive book on Reb Chaim Volozhiner, Avi HaYeshivos by Dov Eliach, he says that on the building it says that the year Tov Kuf Samar Gimel, which is like the end of 1802, and there's a letter which Reb Chaim Volozhiner wrote in the Aser Simei Tshuva of the beginning of Tov Kuf Samar Gimel, which was still 1802, that he's referring in the letters, referring to the opening of the yeshiva. In those years, we can't imagine us living, coming from the United States, coming from the Western countries, and even living in Israel, that the government had tight control over everything, and if the yeshiva was open, it was open secretly, because there were laws in the country that 10 people couldn't get together for anything. So if the yeshiva was open, the government didn't become aware of it until 3 years later. That's why in their papers it said that the yeshiva opened in 1805. Now, how did Reb Chaim Volozhiner go about opening the yeshiva? He of course discussed it with his rebbe, the Vilna Gaon. And Rav Shach said that the Gaon took 3 years after the idea was raised. It took 3 years for the Gaon to finally approve it. Now, according to this Sefer Avi HaYeshivos about Reb Chaim Volozhiner, Reb Chaim Volozhiner is the one who brought up the idea of opening a yeshiva. But Reb Aaron Soloveitchik Zichrono Livracha, the brother of Yerov's Rebbe, whom he just mentioned in his introduction of me. So Reb Aaron Soloveitchik told me as follows. He said, Reb Itzale, that's Reb Itzale of Volozhin, the son of Reb Chaim Volozhin, who was 17 years old when the Vilna Gaon died. The year the Vilna Gaon died, he was 17. So Reb Itzale wanted to study medicine in his youth. That's what he said. And of course, Aaron Soloveitchik added, in order to heal the Jewish sick. Now, inasmuch as the medical schools were located in Italy, Rabbi Chalais studied and mastered both Italian and Latin from translations of Tanakh. When his father learned of the youth's wayward ideal, he told the Vilna Gaon, who advised Rav Chaim to set up a yeshiva. And later Rav Chaim Volozhiner was to say, I cemented my itzale into the yeshiva. Chabam ein gimoyot into the yeshiva. Now, we should assume that both stories are right. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's story, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik stemmed from Rav Chaim Volozhiner. His grandfather, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, was named for this, his predecessor, Rav Chaim of Volozhin. So we should assume that what Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said was true. On the other hand, Rav Shach also had a Masora, and it took 3 years. So I believe that at the age of 14, Rav Chaim got wind of what his son Itzale wanted to do. At the age of 14, he already had plans to be a doctor. And he raised this problem with the Vilna Gaon. My son wants to be a doctor. How should I prevent it? And it took 3 years for the Vilna Gaon to say, set up a yeshiva. And that way, you'll safeguard that the Bitzale should remain in the world of Torah. Now, this proves, and this is something that I reached, the conclusion that I reached as I was preparing this lecture, that at the very beginning of the founding of yeshivas, a yeshiva was to be run by family. And that's the way yeshivas were run throughout their history. It's an embarrassing point that a yeshiva will not necessarily be transferred to the big Islam, but to another member of the family. The story proves it. And this is the way it's been going on ever since in yeshivas. In the Slabodki yeshiva, where my father studied, Slabodki yeshiva was founded 80 years after the mother yeshiva, in 1882, my father studied there. It was headed by the Rosh Hashiva, Moshe Marta Epstein, and the Mashgiach. The Mashgiach is really who brought in the Rosh Hashiva. The Nassim Tzvi Finkel, the altar of Sabbatke, whom I named for Nassim. And when he wanted to appoint his son, Rabbeisha Finkel, the altar of Sabbatke, wanted to appoint him in 1912 to be a magachir in the yeshiva, Sir Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, the Sridayesh, he was considered to be the greatest founder of the Sabbatki yeshiva, and Reb Chaim Sarna told me he would have been the Gadol HaDor of that generation, but for the fact that he divorced his wife. So in those years, the only people who divorced their wives would be a balagola, simple people. But a rav had to chew, that's the expression, bison the perane, chew the quill, chew under the covers and stick it out with his wife. He divorced his wife, and that's why he wasn't recognized anymore. But he was, in fact, you know, from his form, the Sidi Eish was the greatest Talmud of Sabbath of the generation. And he brought up this point to Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel. He said, why are you appointing your son? If he would have heard my lecture, he would have said very simply, this is the way of yeshivas. What did the altar of Sabbat answer? He said like this, my yeshiva told and enticed me to oppose the appointments in order, A, to overcome the instinctive love of a father for his children. It's a kind of an instinct that a person has to be able to control. So in this way, if you want to appoint someone else, he'd be overcoming, he'd be breaking his instinct. And B, to remove suspicion from himself. But he said, I was compelled to nominate him because he could buttress my Musar mode and preserve the unique character of the yeshiva. He would have been considered for the post even if he had not been related to me. And I found myself obligated to overcome my yetzer tov in this matter and appoint him. Now, this story is written up in the Tnuas HaMusar. That's the study of the Musar movement by Rav Dov Kais, who lived on Rechav HaMalot in Jerusalem. I visited him when I came for my first time and visited Israel in 1965. Still alive, Rav Dov Kais, he was a son-in-law of Rav Zev Gold, the famous Mizrahi leader, and he wrote many volumes, anthology of the Musar movement. So he writes this. But a letter that Rav Weinberg wrote after the book was published, he wrote a letter to Rav Dov Kais to fill in on things that had written in the book. So this letter is at the end of Rav Dov Kais's son. He has a son living in Male Adumim, and he has the letter. And he writes in there as follows. The altar brought up a criticism against Kellan, the musician, that it practiced nepotism. So Rabbi Weinberg says, as I spoke up saying to the altar that he was governing in Slabotki in the same manner. And the altar raised his silver cane as if to hit me, and I ran out of the house. Then he sent a messenger, Rabbi Avraham Grudzinski, who was my uncle later. My father and he married two sisters. He was a big Talmud of the Altar of Slabotka. So he came to my room to prove that in his case it was done without self-interest. When he explained the matter to me, I told the messenger that he had convinced me. But Rav Avraham Grudzinski said that the Altar instructed him to spend 2 hours convincing me. And since 2 hours had not yet passed, he had to repeat everything again to make sure I properly understood what he told me. This is what Rev Weinberg wrote to the author of Tnuas HaMusar. Now, somebody told me very recently, this is in the improved edition, told me November 21st, 2003, that Rabbi Yitzchak Chaim was told by Rabbi Weinberg, this is already when Rabbi Weinberg was in Switzerland after the war, he told him that when the branch of Slabotki Yeshiva was built in 1924 in Hebron, the Hebron Yeshiva was built by the Slabotki Yeshiva, I won't go into the reason why, but when that was built, and Moshe Mortzel, the Rosh Hashiva, went over to Palestine then, from Lithuania, in order to build up this branch of the Slabotka, in the city of Hebron then, of course it was. And he brought his son-in-law, who was Reb Chaim Sinai's father, Reb Chaskel Sinai, the son-in-law of Moshe Mortzel. So he said, Rabbi Weinberg told him, that when this branch was being set up and there was a discussion as to which staff member should be transferred from Slabotka to that choice post, where Moshe Mortzel was going, and after concluding that his son, Rabbi Meisha Finkel, was best suited, and he wrote down all the qualities that's needed and all that, the summary was that his son Reb Meisha should be sent to Eretz Yisrael. You have to understand that the Litvakes were very staunch Zionists. And in order that they had an opportunity to move from Lithuania to Eretz Yisrael, everyone would jump at that chance. So this was a choice, the posting. And after he made the whole Chesh, who should be sent, so he concluded that his son Meisha should be sent. But fearing that the decision was based on self-interest, he tore up the paper and cited the liberation again. Again, he reached the conclusion that Tremesha Finkel should go to Eretz Yisrael. And he tore up a second time. It's only after the third try did he say, well, we have to let it stand. My son Tremesha will be the one going to Eretz Yisrael. So when Rabbi Weinberg told the story, he added that he was moved by self-interest after all. It seems that Rabbi Grudzinski's session 12 years earlier had failed in spite of his having repeated his master Yalta's Habakkuk's instructions. But as I said, something to be ashamed of, you could have said, yeshivas are transferred to their children. This is the way it's been since the very founding of the Voloshin Yeshiva. When Reb Chaim Voloshin established the Voloshin Yeshiva, he issued a call that yeshivas be set up in other towns too. In fact, in 1808, 6 years after Voloshin Yeshiva was founded, Blumkes Klois, there was a shul called Blumkes, because a lady, Blumke Dilenkin, is the one who founded this shul. So yeshiva was set up in Minsk, in Blumkes Klois yeshiva. There was a lot of Torah in Minsk from the time, in the middle of the 18th century, from the time of the Shagasari, with different shuls maintaining respective level groups of Talmidim, which I know about because my father came to that outstanding city of Minsk, the capital of Belarus, to study in 90 from his little town. He came to learn there in 1902. He was 11 years old at the time, and he would sleep on the benches of the shul and learn from Minsk. But Blumkes Klois became a focal point for Bachman to travel to from other towns, and it was operated by an administration and a Rosh Yeshiva. It was set up as a yeshiva back in 1808. I want to diverge for a moment to tell you about an episode at which I was not present, but it was reported to me by an activist in Be'er HaGola. I don't know if you're familiar with the organization. It's an organization for Russian Jews who moved to America, came to America. And they're the ones, my father was behind it. As soon as the movement of Jews to America started, and of course the Russian Jews knew nothing, as you know that, they know nothing about Yiddishkeit, and the children knew even less. So, in order to build educational institutions, yeshivas, where Russian children, Jewish children coming from Russia, should learn. So my father was behind the whole inception of the Be'er HaGola, and I was told this in this episode by Ben Safer, who lives in Shari Chesed, who was one of the a major founder of Be'er HaGola, and he recalled that at a dinner of Be'er HaGola, just a couple of years after it was founded, so a child, an 11-year-old boy from Minsk, said a Dvar Torah, and he said it in Russian, of course. My father knew Russian. And after the boy said his Dvar Torah, my father got up to speak. And my father told how when he was a child, and he lived in this town, Dolhinov, after the mass Jewish immigration began to the Western world, to America, and there were some people, some Jews who moved from Dolhinov to America, and they didn't make it, and they came back to the little town, and they brought the children back. Now these children had already gone to public school in America. So the other Jewish children were told by the parents not to play with those kids coming back from America, because after all, they picked up some evil influences in the Treif and Medina, in the forbidden country of America. And my father said then, when he was speaking at this Be'er HaGola dinner, he was cautioning religious American Jews not to reject their co-religionists arriving from Russia now that the shoe is on the other foot. And then my father said, he described Minsk, the city where this little 11-year-old boy had come from. And he told them, there were 600 people in the audience, and he told the people what Minsk was like. It had 83 shuls, and in many of the shuls there were boys sleeping on the benches, studying Torah and Balabatim, who would feed the youngsters. And he told about the seven charities in the city, the support for the poor, hospitality for the sick. They didn't have a hospital there yet that people would provide for the sick who are laid up at home. there was, of course, a Filon society. There was redemption of captives. They called it Pidyon Shvuyim. What it means is that when someone was drafted, conscripted, and they were able to bribe the officials to free him from the army, this is called Pidyon Shvuyim. Dowries for brides, tuition for poor students, boys feeding for food for Pesach. So my father described what a city Minsk was like with its Torah and its Chesed. And he concluded, all of Minsk was destroyed by the communists and then the Nazis. All that remains of Minsk is this little boy. And there wasn't a dry eye in the whole audience. Anyways, the first yeshiva that listened to Rav Chaim Volozhiner's call and set up a yeshiva, the first city, was Minsk. Lumkas Kloyd Yeshiva. In 1865, a fire destroyed the Volozhiner Yeshiva, and the Rav of Krynik sent a letter to Minsk, the leaders of Minsk Jewry, and he told and he repeated to them what had happened when the Lumkas Kloyd Yeshiva was founded, and he describes it all, and he says that Rav Chaim Volozhiner sent 10 of his best Talmidim in order to establish the branch, we'll call it, the daughter yeshiva of the mother yeshiva, the first one in Minsk. He was writing back to Minsk because Minsk had many wealthy Jews, and he wanted them to participate warmly in the rebuilding of the Volozhiner yeshiva building. This Lumkas Kloyd yeshiva was 1808. In 1815, the Mir Yeshiva was established, all because of the call of Rav Chaim Volozhiner. And the Mir Yeshiva is now the oldest yeshiva in the world. You probably heard of Rav Avram Kalmanovich, Avad Hatzalah fame. He saved the Mir Yeshiva and supported it while it was during the Second World War years in Shanghai. And he said that the reason why the Mir Yeshiva, of all the yeshivas existing at the outbreak of the Second World War, why it was the Mir Yeshiva that was saved? Because it was the oldest yeshiva. And just like the destruction of the first temple, the Chorosh and Mazgir, 11 years before it was destroyed, the Talmidei Chachamim, the learners, were exiled into Babylonia. And they set up Torah over there as a forerunner to the exile of the entire Jewish people into Babel through Nebuchadnezzar. They were sent in advance to set up Torah, to set up Yeshiva. In the second Beis Hamikdash, before it was destroyed, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai saved Yavne. They said the Torah should continue in its form, in its Masorah, in spite of the destruction of the second Beis Hamikdash. And similarly, said Rav Kalmanovich, because of the great Churban of the Holocaust, so the Mir Yeshiva was sent out to be saved because it had the skus of being the oldest yeshiva. Now, in America, the Mir Yeshiva is run by Rav Kalmanovich's family. He had an official title in the, it was called the Nasi of the Yeshiva. Of course, here the Mir Yeshiva is run by the Rosh Yeshiva. The Rosh Yeshiva Mir was Rav Kamai, and Rav Yehuda Finkel was his son-in-law, and then Rav Benish Finkel, and now Rav Nassim Tzvi Finkel, the son-in-law of Rav Benish Finkel. It goes going down through the generations in the family. As I said, it's a yeshiva, so it goes into the family. And I hope the children of Rav Avraham Kalmanovich understand, like what Rav Kalmanovich wrote about. He was a great publicist. Rav Kalmanovich, if he would have been alive, so 10 years from now, 2015, he would celebrate a bicentennial of the Mir Yeshiva. It was established in 1815. And I hope they also celebrate this landmark event, for the yeshiva, the oldest yeshiva in existence now, is almost 200 years old. It'll be 200 years in 2015. Now, it's a remarkable thing. For 70 years, no more yeshivas were established. No famous yeshivas were established. Reb Chaim Volozhiner died in 1821, 6 years after the new yeshiva was founded. And obviously, his son, Reb Yitzchak, instead of becoming a doctor, took over the yeshiva. He wasn't so enthused about spreading the gospel of yeshiva building, and yeshivas weren't built anymore until the Talmidim of the Yisrael Salanter started building yeshivas as an expression of the Muslim movement. That's why it took so many years for other yeshivas to be built. I'm going to mention three yeshivas: Telz, Slabotka, and Radin. The reason why I mention these three yeshivas that were established in the 1880s, because later I'll speak about how these yeshivas reacted to the closing of the Lush. But these three yeshivas were established, let's start first with Telz, because Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel, who was a Talmud of the prime Talmud of Reb Yisrael Salanter. Reb Yisrael Salanter had three major Talmudim. Reb Simcha Zissel of Kelan, and Reb Itzel of Petersburg. He was, the capital then wasn't Moscow, but it was St. Petersburg. And now it is Leningrad, now it's got St. Petersburg again. He was the Rav of the capital, and he was a Talmud of Reb Yisrael Salanter. They called him Reb Itzel Petabulgel. And another third Talmud, Reb Naftali Amsterdam. But Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel, the Alter Salaki, he was already a Talmud of Reb Simcha Zissel. The Talmud of the Talmud of Reb Yisrael Salanter. So Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel, he was born in 1849, the same year that the Bitzaleh of Volozhin died. That's when the Alter of Slobodka was born. He started the Telz Yeshiva when he was a young man of 32 years old, in 1881. Not that he went to Telz, but he organized the yeshiva and sent Talmidim there, and he got the monetary support for it. It was 1881. But the small yeshiva, 3 years later, in 1884, was when the Blazer Gordon, he came to Telz, he became the Rav, and that's when the yeshiva took off and became one of the major yeshivas. But that Telz was 1881, it counts its beginning, from 1881. A year later, 1882, that's when the Nosson Tzvi Finkel himself started a yeshiva in Slobodka as part of the Kovna Kolel. What does it mean, Kovna Kolel? The Kolel, it's not like RLEF Kolel now, where Talmidim get together and learn the same subjects and things like that. It was an organization that supported married young men to learn. There could be three married men learning in one shul, three in another shul, three in another town. And this organization, Kovna Kolel, supported them. Why? Before that, wealthy people would take sons-in-law who were Talmidei Chachamim, they would support them while they advanced and developed in Torah. But since times changed and people started taking not Talmidei Chachamim, but lawyers and accountants and doctors for sons-in-law, so then the community undertook, this was Reb Yisrael Salanter's idea, that now the community has to undertake to support these outstanding in the life will become great Rabbanim, etc. So this is the Kovna Kolel. So the Alter of Slobodka, he was a young man then, he was 33 years old in 1882. So he said that the Kolel was now, this was for a few years already. So he said to one of the leaders of the Kolel, who was another Talmud of Reb Yisrael Salanter, Reb Yitzchak Petterburger, and he told him, just like you have to train, young people to become rabbonim, you have to train some young people to become Rosh Yeshivas. So the cost of covering four boys, four unmarried boys, is the same as taking in one married fellow. So therefore, they took in some boys, four, eight, 12, decided to be a yeshiva, under the auspices of the Kovna Kola. That was 1882. In 1889, they already took the realm of Rosh Yeshiva, they became an independent yeshiva, Sabotki yeshiva. But it counts its establishment from 1882. Now, Rabin has various dates that it counts its beginning from. It's an interesting thing. There's a very good book, Bishvilei Rabin, by the Rabin Yeshiva, and it has over there a picture of a receipt from the Rabin Yeshiva, a receipt book, that says it like this. It says in Hebrew and in English, for the American donors. So in Hebrew it says, it was established in Tafresh Chavdalad, that's 1864. In the English it says, it's established in 5642, 1882, and in parentheses, 1864. Now, just the dates don't gel. Now, so studying the history of the Rabin Yeshiva, it seems as follows. The Chafetz Chaim lived in Rabin, he's a private person. The people heard he's a Talmid Chacham, so people came to live there and to learn there and so on, because they had the Chafetz Chaim there. He lived there in Rabin from 1869. It was not a yeshiva, it was a Rosh Yeshiva. When his daughter got married, he married his daughter off to a young man, Rav Hirsch Levinson, in 1885. That's when the yeshiva was started. And together with his son-in-law, who died in 1921, he died 12 years before his father-in-law. And the Rabin Yeshiva was still in exile from the First World War, even though the war was over in 1918. But the Russian communist government didn't allow people to go back to Poland. They were still stuck in Russia. And it was the cold winter, and this tzaddik, Rav Hirsch Levinson, gave away his boots to a Talmud whose shoes were torn, and he took the Talmud's torn shoes, and he got sick that winter, and when he died, the Chafetz Chaim had a suffix whether he's permitted to say Hesped on him. Maybe he's considered like a suicide. Interesting question. But he died in 1921. This son-in-law of the Chafetz Chaim, who had actually started the Rabin Yeshiva with his father-in-law. Okay. Now let's get back to Volozhin. Rabbi Tzaleh was a Rosh Yeshiva from 1821 till he died in 1849. That's for 28 years. 9 years longer than his father, Rabbi Chaim Volozhin, was a Rosh Yeshiva from 1802 to 1821. He was already 28 years. After he died, so who became Rosh Yeshiva? A son-in-law of his, Rabbi Eliezer Fried, who lived only 4 more years, and then another son-in-law of Rabbi Tzaleh, who was Rabbi Herschleib Berlin. This is the Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda, that's the acronym of Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. And in Yiddish they call him Hersh, like Tzvi is Hersh, and Yehuda is Leib, of Hersh Leib. The Netziv will call him the Netziv. He became the Rosh Yeshiva, and he became in 1853, he became Rosh Yeshiva at the age of 36, and he was a Rosh Yeshiva till the Yeshiva closed out, the Netziv. He reigned for 39 years, 11 years longer than his predecessor. In 1880, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, who was married to the Netziv's granddaughter, was given the post of assistant Rosh Yeshiva. like the Nesir himself had been, or his father-in-law had still been alive. Yet he wasn't a Rashid, he was an assistant, he was a Rashir in the Yeshiva. And in 1880, the Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was appointed to be assistant Rosh Yeshiva in Volozh. This was the story of Volozh, the mother Yeshiva, and its daughters, only two daughters that actually had, and then there were other yeshivas that were built not as daughters of Volozh, but because of Rav Yisroel Salanter's influence and the influence of his Talmidim, Rav Simcha Zissel and Rav Bissel Ben Yehuda, through the altar of Sabbatim. Rav Shach once told me that all the Torah that's in existence in the world now is thanks to the altar of Slobodka. He was speaking then to me about Moshe Reichman, the wealthy Reichmans from Toronto. And there was a time they were paying off all the debts of the yeshivas here in Israel. I don't remember which year it was, but if I look it up in the making of the God, I'll find the exact year. That Rav Shach told me that the altar of Sabotken was the money that he got from somebody, Ovadia Lachman, a wealthy man from Berlin. With his money, is responsible for all the Torah in existence now. And he says, maybe now, with the money from Reichman, history will repeat itself. This is what the Shach told me personally. Now we get to the second part of my lecture about the closure of Volozh. Having shown that yeshivas from their inception are private fiefdoms handed over to family members, we're faced with two problems. One problem is, how can the level of scholarship be maintained when children are not necessarily as learned as their predecessors, their antecedents? So how do you maintain? If it allows saying the family, so how can we make sure that the level of scholarship will be maintained? The answer to this problem is that the laws of inheritance changed in the yeshivas. Instead of sons inheriting the posts from their fathers, the daughters began to inherit them. What do I mean? Not that the daughters became Rosh Yeshiva, but the daughter's husband, whom naturally the father would handpick, and he would pick the biggest one. And the Yerusha and Yeshiva transferred, instead of being given over from father to son, was given over from father-in-law to son-in-law. And my father used to say that. He said, from Ravitzel Volozhiner's time, inheritance goes to sons-in-law, not to sons. And this is the way it was with yeshivas, with rabbinic positions in Lithuania. The son-in-law was a yorish, not the son. So we solved the problem, how to maintain the level of scholarship. But there's another problem, a second problem, and that problem is unfortunately insoluble. What are there several family members who are worthy of becoming Rosh Yeshiva? How can in-family squabbling be avoided? And unfortunately, it can't. Time doesn't permit us to delve into the reasons for the closure of the Volozh. Everyone knows the tradition that the Russian government wanted to bring in secular studies into the curriculum of the yeshiva, and the Russian yeshiva refused, so the government closed the yeshiva down. But few people know about the other reason, which some books have as a major reason why the yeshiva closed. There was a family squabble. The Nitziv, 75 years old, who had inherited the yeshiva from his father-in-law, he wanted to retire and move to Eretz Yisrael, as his father had done several decades earlier. Like I said, a Litvak is a Zionist. Reb Chaim Berlin was a son of the Nitziv, and he had been Rav in Moscow. He was only 15 years younger than his father, because in the Nesiv married at the age of 14. And his son, Rav Chaim Berlin, some of you may have learned the Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin in America. Chaim Berlin was a son of the Nesiv, of the Naftali of the Herschleim Berlin. And he was, the Nesiv wanted to hand over the head of the Yeshiva, the heading of the Yeshiva, to his son, Rav Chaim Berlin. But many Talmidim, you might say, even most of the Talmidim possibly, wanted the assistant Rosh Yeshiva, the nephew of Rav Chaim Berlin. It's all in the family, remember. The nephew of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik to become the Rosh Yeshiva. And it's no difference what the principles themselves, what they held, if they were part of the squabble. If the Talmidim themselves fought among themselves, someone to this one, someone to the other one, naturally the yeshiva couldn't go on. The fighting reached such a level that some Talmidim stole Reb Chaim Berlin's lulav and esrog. And Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was the one who threatened the boys with expulsion. And they were returned to Dalet Minim, and as a result, the windows of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik's house were broken. You know, there are disputes in present-day yeshivas too. For example, in the Panevez yeshiva, there's a lot of fighting going on. A dispute between a son of Reb Avram Kahneman, of course, the one who built the yeshiva was the old Panevez Yadav, and he left an only son, Reb Avram Kahneman, and he has a son and a son-in-law, and there's fighting over there. Who should be the Rosh Yeshiva? The son of Reb Avram Kahneman or the son-in-law? And recently, one of the adversaries, who was a Kohen, was Duchening, and they didn't steal the Arba Minyan, they stole his shoes. This happened in Valashin, the following the old Valashin tradition of battling who the Rosh Yeshiva should be. In the Hebron Yeshiva, there was a bit of machlokes about 25 years ago between Reb Chaim Sarna, the only son of Reb Chavsko Sarna, I mentioned earlier, who came to Eretz Yisrael together with his father-in-law, Reb Shamar Tehepsi, in 1924, to found the Hebron Yeshiva. So his son, Reb Chaim Sarna, had a machlokes with other members of the family. So the children of another son-in-law of Reb Shamar Chai, the Hebroni family, as who should be Rosh Yeshiva. The Hebron machlokes was resolved because toward about 25 years ago, Reb Shach incidentally said then that the only one who could really resolve it properly was my father, Zechana Livracha. My father was too old to participate in it. Why did Reb Shach say that my father? Because my father knew the history of Slobodka and the history of Hebron so well that he could adjudicate who the yeshiva really belongs to. But that's what Reb Shach said at that time. But he resolved the problem, and Reb Chaim Sarna took the building in Geula, the Hebron Yeshiva in Geula, and the rest of the family took the yeshiva in Givat Mordechai, and that problem was resolved. But in Panevez, there's still a machlokas going on, and we don't know how this will end. But just imagine if the Panevez yeshiva with Chas V'Shalom closed down. What a trauma the Jewish world would experience. So we can imagine what a trauma the Jewish world experienced when the Volozhin Yeshiva was closed down in 1892. All the more so because when the Volozhin Yeshiva closed down, besides the Mir Yeshiva, the only old established Yeshiva, they said there were the other Yeshivas, Tells, Rabin, Sabotkin, they were less than a decade old. And now the mother Yeshiva, the Volozhin, closed down. So let us examine how traumatic was the closure of the Volozhin in those three Yeshivas. Tells, Rabin, and Slobodka. Tells Yeshiva seemed to have been most affected. Why do I say that? Because half a year later, in Chol HaMoed of Sukkot, this is written up. It's written up in 1927. Written up, a play was put on by the Tells Talmidim about the closure of Halashon, Chol HaMoed Sukkot. And the Rosh Yeshiva was so moved by it that he put it up, put it on again the night of Shmini Atzeres. And the whole day in Shaina Rabba, how did he spend his day in Shaina Rabba? He spent the whole day in Shaina Rabba setting up the stage and the props for the play to be repeated in his own house the night of Shmini Atzeres. And the way he described here what happened was the play was a kind of a part morality play. A morality play is a dramatized allegory with its characters' abstractions, abstractionized characters. Now the characters in this play were the Netziv, some Talmidim, and the Talmud was a character, and the Talmud was a child of the Ben Yochid, an only child of the Torah, and the mother, the Torah, the child of God, is another character, and Knesset Yisrael, and Eliyahu HaNavi. They are the characters in this morality play describing the closure of Halashon. The first scene has, when the curtain is raised, it has the Talmidim sitting and learning, and the Mashgiach walking down the aisle, checking that everyone is learning, and the Netziv is standing there with a smile on his face, he's enjoying the way the Talmidim are learning, a simcha shel mitzvah, and suddenly walks in the governor and the goyim and everyone with and they announce that the yeshiva has to be closed and so on. And then the Netziv falls down the fence and the curtain drops. The second scene has the Netziv and the Talmidim are trying to comfort him. That one Talmud speaks and the Netziv responds, and a different Talmud speaks and a third Talmud speaks. The Netziv is inconsolable. The third scene has a young man, the Talmud, lying in bed, ailing and beseeching God to save him. The Talmud is praying, the Talmud, and he's, I'm going to read some 10 lines, I'm left. Let me read them first in Yiddish, and then I'll translate them for you. He's saying, Ich Talmud, starb up from the Welt. Ich muss schon gehen in ewigen Gezelt. Ich muss von der Welt weggehen. Und teurer mein Mutter, lassen allein. Mutter, as if so lach me himmel arroich, bleibst du doch wie eine Schramme ohne Guff. Bitte, Mutter, Gott von mir, ich steh doch schön beim Tier. Knesset Yisrael, wo lost du dir? He said, I come and die from this world. I must go to my eternal tent. I must leave this world and Torah, my mother, leave the band. Mother dear, if I go to heaven, you will remain as a soul without a body. Pray, Mother, to God for me. I'm standing at the gate. Knesset Yisrael, how am I leaving her? How will she survive without me? Talmud is saying Torah can't exist without Talmud. The fourth, and then in the same scene, we have the mother speaking. The mother is pictured as an old wise woman with the word Emes written on her forehead, and she's carrying a candle and she's crying about the what's happening to her ailing son, that her son is about to go leave this world. The fourth scene has Knesset Yisrael, also an old woman, wizened, full of wrinkles, and in one hand she's carrying a Sefer Torah, and the other hand a cane, a wandering cane, with a backpack that he could wander from Knesset Yisrael, wandering from country to country. And he's also crying to God, trying to save the Talmud, trying to save the Torah. The last scene has the Netziv standing at the grave of Reb Chaim Volozhiner. And they show a monument, and it says here is buried Reb Chaim Volozhiner, and the Netziv is there, and he's praying at the grave. And he puts down the key to the building, and he says, here is the key to your yeshiva. Go unlock it. Don't sleep, Zayde. Your yeshiva is closed. My strength is waning. And he faints again, and the curtain drops, and it lifts up again, and who's there with the Netziv? Eliyahu HaNavi is there with the Netziv. And Eliyahu HaNavi, of course, likes to comfort him and so on. And the play has, Eliyahu HaNavi says, God has opened another spring which will for Jews provide life as long as your yeshiva will be missing. And until God will unlock it, and then both springs will flow with life. Which new spring is the place speaking about? The Tel's yeshiva, of course. And later they name it. And Eliyahu HaNavi says to the Netziv, give you blessing to Tel's, and I'll say Amen, and he gives a blessing, and Eliyahu HaNavi says Amen, and the whole choir says Amen, as if Tel's is replacing Volozhin, and saying that if Volozhin reopens, so there will be two springs. It's very interesting. The play doesn't mention anything about the cause of the closure of Volozhin, not the Russian government, which no one wants to bring up in Russia, and neither the in-family squabbling, which I spoke about before. There's no cause mentioned. Yeshiva is closed, and Talmud is on a deathbed unless and other yeshivas will open. This is the play, and Tel's took the closure of Volozhin very seriously. The one who describes it on, the one who quotes the whole lines, it was written, the whole play was written by an 18-year-old Talmud of Tel's then. But 1927, when this was written out, there were many copies in Lithuania, and this Talmud had become a respectable rav in Lithuania. And he told how, when he was there, when the show when it was put on, the way everyone was so moved, the Talmidim were crying and the Rashidim were crying about the closing of Tel's, the closing of Volozhin. Tel's took it very badly. What about Radin? Radin seemed to be affected, but to a lesser degree than Tel's. I found that the Chafetz Chaim was once telling the story of the closing of Volozhin, and he tells that he is very speaking about the cause, and he says the Rosh Yeshivas of Volozhin preferred to decided to close the yeshiva rather to bring in secular studies. And the Chafetz Chaim said, had they permitted bringing in secular studies, it would have caused Torah in its unadulterated form to be forgotten from among Jewish people. And once they disallowed it, yeshiva without secular studies open, which later became fortresses of Torah in our generation. Like a blocked spring, the Torah found other routes and trails by which to burst forth when it was obstructed in Volozhin. He uses that muscle from the play, and he says it's like a spring, and you can't block up a spring. If you block up one exit for the waters, it'll burst out some other place. And this is the spring of Torah. In other words, it wasn't such a tragic event that the Lashon calls, because it's like a spring, and it'll go, it'll open somewhere else. And on the contrary, it'll open in another, it should be. The son-in-law of the Chofetz Chaim, who really is responsible for opening the Yeshiva's Ram, he also spoke about it. I found this from another source. And he said the Chorban was terrible. Why? But he says, what was the Chorban? Because in Volozhin there were 400 Talmidim then. And they were expelled from the town. They had to leave. 400 Talmidim had to take their wandering stick in their hands. This is what bothered Reb Tzvi, Reb Hirsch Levinson. This is a tragedy. And he says, and instead of Volozhin, other yeshivas grew. They developed Altaras HaKodesh. And he said it again, like his father-in-law said, it's a good thing that it malalim udechay, and so on. And he added that in Germany, where they made sheres, they compromised with Torah and with the chay, Torah and Berecheret, as it's called nowadays. So that caused the German Jewry to forget Columbus, and a short time it disappeared, and so on. In other words, they're taking a lesson from the leadership of Volozhin, and they're very happy that Volozhin closed down and didn't submit to bringing in secular studies, and it was tragic and so on, but bearable. This was the attitude of the Rav Yeshiva. And now let's see how Volozhin, or rather Sabotka Yeshiva, reacted to the closure of Volozhin. The statement I found, Sabotka, about the closure of Volozhin was made 10 years after the event by Rabbi Yechiel Yankov Weinberg. He said, Sabotka inherited, the Volozhin Yeshiva closed, and Sabotka inherited its place and its name in the Torah world. In other words, He just transferred. He said its place and its name. And I have sources to show the Sabotka Yeshiva even wanted to take the name. What's the name of the Chaim Yeshiva? Chaim Yeshiva Volozhin? Eitz Chaim. Eitz Chaim. And for a while, the Sabotka Yeshiva, who didn't have a name yet there in 1892, so just part of the covenant color, and it became a different, but it didn't have a name. Just called the Sabotka Yeshiva, took it, and the name Eitz Chaim. Like this. Volozhin has been replaced by Sabotka. Why did Sabotka take it least badly? Why did Sabotka not take to heart that Volozhin closed down? In my opinion, the answer lies in the character of the Sabotka Yeshiva. Of the three yeshivas, Kells at that time, and Ravin, and Sabotka, only Sabotka was a true Musar yeshiva. The altar of Sabotka was a Talmud, as I said, of Rav Simcha Zissel, who was the major Talmud of Rav Yisrael Salanter. To the altar of Sabotka, Musar was a vital factor in Judaism. In 1925, when they wanted to publish the writings of Rav Simcha Zissel of Kellen, so they asked the Alter of Sabotka, who was already in Eretz Yisrael, he died in 1927, they asked him if he would write an introduction to this anthology of the writings of Rav Simcha Zissel is ready. So he wrote like this, his letter reads as follows. As for me, the merits of my forefathers stood by me to become acquainted with my master teacher and Rebbe of Simcha Zissel, speaking about. At the beginning, in my weak eyes, and in the eyes of many of the greats, I beheld a topsy-turvy world when I first met my Rebbe of Simcha Zissel. But after several years passed, I began to see somewhat that we had all wandered from the sensible road. The true light of Torah had not shone on me. And I had traded truth for falsity and good for evil. And the character of Torah for its opposite. In other words, the author of Sabbat can look for Torah, for Yiddishkeit, without Musar as being evil, as being the opposite of the character of Torah, being false, and having learned by the Simcha Zissel, I came to see the true light of Torah hadn't shone on me for several years until I realized it. And I came to understand that this man, the Simcha Zissel, the Talmud of the Bissar Salanta, preeminent among a myriad, was not a man but a spirit of God would speak from him. As a result of the merits of his great immersion in and meditation on Torah for its own sake, Torah Lishma. He credited the Simcha Zissel's greatness to learn Torah Lishma, for which one acquires Zeichel Lidvaram Halti. He attributes his meeting of Simcha Zissel to the merits of his forefathers, because he had come to that change his attention in a roundabout providential way. A Talmud of the Kelan Talmud Torah, he was a resident of Kelan for many years. He told me there was a tradition in the town that Reb Finkel, the altar of Sabbat, Moshe Tzvi Finkel, when he arrived in Kelan, he wasn't coming there to learn in Kelan, but he was just there. He was a really married young man. He was considered by the close Talmidim of Reb Simcha Zissel too worldly and modern to be suited to become a Talmud of the altar of Kelan. Nonetheless, he was perceived to be very talented. They decided to take the chance, and they persuaded him to request permission. This is a prerequisite. In order to go into Yiras Shmuas from Reb Simcha Zissel in Kelan, you have to get permission. So they came to they persuaded him to ask permission of Reb Simcha Zissel to attend, to listen to Yiras Shmuas. Reb Simcha Zissel's talk was so overpowering that Reb Finkel altered his way of thinking, which opened the way for him to become a Talmud. Regarding the power of Reb Simcha Zissel's Musar talks, I'll recount what Reb Simcha Zissel's son-in-law and successor in Kelan, son-in-law, remember, in Kelan, Reb Hirsch Breuder, he explained the difference between his father-in-law's Kelan, Reb Simcha Zissel, and his own. What did he say? When one's stomach is diseased, a surgeon is able to cure it by cutting out 3/4 of the stomach. If a specialist is unavailable, the regular doctor will prescribe a very strict diet to enable the patient to continue to live with this condition. He said, Reb Ziv was able through a single shmuz to cut out the evil within the individual. Now we learn Torah and Musar, we have shmuz, but the Kelan Talmud Torah is only a type of diet which keeps us going despite our afflictions. But this is the power of Reb Simcha Zissel, the Rebbe of the Alta Sabbatia. Since Reb Finkel perceived the general non-Musar view of Torah in such a totally negative light, it is little wonder that he fought for the ascendancy of the Musar approach with such ferocity. As a result of his deep conviction that Musar is the only true understanding of what Judaism is, and any other approach is the opposite of what Torah seeks. This is why he describes it. The opposite. He didn't relax his concern that Musar be disseminated in the citadels of Torah study, and despite having won his battles in the Musar dispute, the big Musar dispute in 1897, and at the turn of the century, he didn't feel secure in his victory until around 1910. There was a poem written by Rabbi Elia Kaplan. He wrote a poem, I'll just read it in translation, about describing the struggle of the Alta Sabbatka from Musar. And it was written around, I think, in 1912, like, I would say about 2 years after the Alta Sabbatka was already felt that he doesn't have to fight for Musar anymore. So he writes like this: the spark of the heart of the sage of Israel, speaking about Alta Sabbatka, fanned by his past, guided by the force of his presence, solaced by his moral, angered by the rebellion of his challengers, constrained in the cry of his fame, is carried atop the storm in a desert of exile wandering. This is the way he describes the fight of the Alter Sabbatke to promote the study of Musar, the Derech HaMusar. And even Rabban Yeshiva, with the Chofetz Chaim, was not a Musar Yeshiva in the full sense. It is described in a book by Rav Tzvi Salzisel Dvoretz, who was a big Bal Musar. Yeshivas Rabban was conducted all the years according to the old methods of the youth of his founder, the Chofetz Chaim. With his innocent heart, he believed that he would always succeed in running the yeshiva by that system. But the Alter of Sabbatke, the ingenious expert in the field, whose pure eyes glided over the pattern of all those reigning yeshivas, saw and realized it was impossible. In the modern world, we call it modern world, it was impossible to maintain the old type of frumkeit that the Chofetz Chaim represented. Therefore, he constantly made plans how to exert influence on the administration of Yeshivas Rabban to introduce the correct arrangement of the Musar system. His main method was sending the best forces of greatness of Torah and Musar from among his trainees to study the Rabban Yeshiva. There were the live spirits of the Yeshiva who served unofficially as Rosh Yeshiva Musar motivators, Mashpid. Understandably, since they were not appointed officially, their influence was limited. With all this, the Chofetz Chaim avoided bringing in the new methods until the revolutionary spirit of 1905, it was an attempt to overthrow the Tsarist government in 1905 by the socialists, and many yeshivas were caught up in it, and many Rabban Talmidim were involved, like any other yeshivas. Then the Chofetz Chaim began to cave in. Then the Chofetz Chaim agreed to the Alter suggestion and appointments. The appointment he refers to is Rabbi Yeruchem, who was later Mashiach in the Mir. Rabbi Yeruchem was a Talmid, Rabbi Yeruchem the Fabbis, was a Talmid of the Alter of Sabbatke. And the Mashiach in Lakewood, Rabbi Nassim Bachvogel, told me that he learned in the Mir that Rabbi Yeruchem, the Fabbis of the Mir, said that everything he got, everything he was, he gained from the Alter of Sabbatke. He learned the Hebrew, and he doesn't do it, but only for a year or two before 1898, when the Alter of Kelem died. But before that, he learned under the Alter of Sabbatke, and he was his Talmid. So the Alter of Sabbatke told the Yeruchem, the young man, to go learn in Rabban. But it didn't last long there. But Yeruchem decided not to return after 1910, because some Talmidim felt that his influence was drawing students away from under the Chofetz Chaim's wing. A Talmid of Rabbi Yeruchem told me that the Chofetz Chaim, like most of the other Torah grades, was actually against Musar. Now that he was a vehement Misnagdim, he didn't approve the entire approach. And this Talmid told me a story that Rabbi Yeruchem told him to demonstrate the difference between the approach, his approach, the Musar approach, and the Chofetz Chaim's approach. From the time that he was still in Rabban, before 1910. The custom in the small town of Rabban was that when there was a death in the city, in the village, the community members came into the Beis Medrash, banged down on the bima, to announce when the funeral would take place, and the whole yeshiva would attend. Otherwise, there were a few people to participate in the funeral altogether. Rabbi Yeruchem felt that it's outrageous for the yeshiva to cancel a study session for a funeral. And he did away with the custom. And the community members came running to the Chofetz Chaim to complain that someone had died and the yeshiva was not attending the funeral. Chofetz Chaim called in Rabbi Yeruchem and asked him, "Why hide?" So Rabbi Yeruchem gave his explanation. But the Chofetz Chaim responded, "Wise man, be careful with your words." And Rabbi Yeruchem was forced to retract. And the Talmud elucidated, for a Musarite, be from the Mir Yeshiva or the Aldar Sabbat or the Aldar Kelm, to bank on the Bina and close the Yeshiva because the Jew had died was not the way of doing things. Aside from the consideration of Bittul Torah, because which Halacha permitted, obviously, because the Chofetz Chaim, the author of the Mishneh Berurah, approved, but such an act takes away from the entire standing of Torah, Kavod HaTorah, which is a matter that the Musar movement saw its major duty to promote in modern times. In this book, the Shvila Rav that I praised before, it's a good book because it's almost truthful. When it tells about when Yerucham was in Radin, and he left, 80 Talmidim went with him. Must have been most of the Talmidim went with him. And then that's when he joined Mir. But they make it as if Yerucham told certain Talmidim not to speak to the Chofetz Chaim, and they interpret it to mean that not to disturb the Chofetz Chaim. But the pshat is different. Because you think something that might be influenced by his outmoded approach to the Yiddishkeit and the Frankheit. And he said, Bachem that had the more sophisticated outlook, they would be hard to speak to the Chofetz Chaim. But otherwise, that they shouldn't speak to the Chofetz Chaim, because then they wouldn't get the chinuch that the Muslim movement that he represented in the Muslim movement was providing them in order to maintain their Yiddishkeit in the modern world. I prepared, but the hour is late, to speak also about the Bessar Sanzer himself. The time doesn't permit it. The Altar Sobotke studied under a Talmud of the Bessar Salanta. The Altar Sobotke himself revealed to my father's brother-in-law, to the Mankozinski, that Musa was not infallible by him until he had once a meeting with the Bessar Salanta in 1882. In 1882, a year before the Bessar Salanta died, was the only time the Altar Sabbatke spoke to the Bessar Salanta. And after he spoke to him, Musa became infallible. Which is very interesting. Now, the Lashon, how did the Lashon Yeshiva react toward Musa? I'm speaking about the later years of the Lashon Yeshiva. Well, Rabbi Yisrael Salanta was already on the scene. I think about 1890, after Rabbi Yisrael Salanta had even died already. Let's speak about 1870s, 1880s, until 1890. How did they take the Musa? First of all, I want to show how both the Netziv, the main Rosh Hashiva, and the Chaim Soloveitchik, they were both anti-Musa. A bacher learning of a lashon had a proclivity to learning musa. They sometimes look into the Mesilas Yesharim, and he brought it into the Seder time, and he looked at it. So some bacher told the Netziv about it, and the Netziv came into the Mesmedrash, and in front of everyone, he censured the Talmud not to waste his time for Torah, but he's learning Mesilas Yesharim. This was the Netziv. Reb Chaim Steiner related the name of his father that Reb Yisrael Salanta had once approached the Netziv and offered him to become a shgiach in the Volozhin Yeshiva. And the Netziv told him, "You're welcome to come, but if you come," and the Yisrael Salanta was one of the greatest heads of the Goyim and Torah too. He was one of the greatest in the century. So he said, "You'll learn that if you come, I'll be forced to leave the yeshiva." This was the Netziv answering the Yisrael Salanta. "You come to the yeshiva, I'll be forced to leave." So of course, this scotch was the Yisrael attempt to personally inject Musa into the Volozhin Yeshiva. But he tried to get some other person engaged there. But the Netziv wouldn't hear of it. in order to prevent Moshe from coming into the Lush. And there's a famous story about Chabit Soteto Bulgar. There's a second town that I mentioned in the Moshe Salanta. He came to Valoshin in 1881. He came to Valoshin and he offered to become Mashgiach there. And there's a whole story which I heard three versions about, but I say they'll all speak true. I heard from Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg. So Nechemia Goldberg was the son-in-law of the late Rav Zalman Orbach. He told me the version that he heard from he said wise and tell exactly when he heard it. And he must have heard it from the Briska, yeah? But the came into the offer to become a Shia Hamishiva when he was turned down. This was after he left his rabbinate position in the capital of Russia, St. Petersburg. And he was turned down. He asked permission to stay at the Russia to say a speech in Yeshiva. And he got permission. So what did he say? He said the anti-Musar argument is that the Gemara says I created a Yetzirah and I created an antidote. Torah, study of Torah. This is the antidote to the Yetzirah. If you need the Yetzirah, pull him into the Besmeglish. In other words, study Torah, that will destroy the Yetzirah. So Rabitzel rejected this argument. This is the anti-Musa. You don't have to study Musa. Learn about the Kabbalah, learn Elohim. Your soul will be vanquished. And he said, he compared it to the two ways of backing the Yitzhar, through the study of Torah or through the exercise of Musa, to the two ways of treating an ailment. There is a segula, an occult practice advocated by a mystic, or a medicine prescribed by a physician. In those years, it was a common thing that you use a segula to ask a psychic how to cure things. The segula remedy will not have any effect unless it's carried out painstakingly to the last detail. If an incantation is ordered to be repeated 7 times, and you repeat it only 6 times, it's worthless. Why? If it's a medicine of a fua, even if it's taken a smaller dosage than the doctor prescribes, it'll help somebody. It'll give some measure of relief. Likewise, he says, studying Torah is a segula for attaining Yirat Shamayim, while Musar is a fua, is a medicine. He said, if the study of Torah is imperfect, like when Paul, let's say, studied that with a foolish shema, then the prescript of the Talmud of combating this villain, the Yetzirah, through the study of Torah is futile. It's worthless. It won't work at all. But with Musar, since it's a refua, since it's a medicine, so even if the Torah is not less perfect, but as much as you'll think of it, it'll help. It'll help somewhat to a degree. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik stood outside the Besmeidrash, and when Reb Itzhak walked out, he told them, he gave a very good speech, but I want you to know that we at Volozhin are not sick as we should need medicine. This is one story. Another story is written by Reb Yoshebel Soloveitchik. Your Rebbe's Rebbe. Your Rav's Rebbe. In Isha Halacha, he's faced with the debate with as follows. The Bitzel proved that Musa was more effective than the study of Torah, because it's another Chazal, which says, a person should try to his Yetzirah, we should back his Yetzirah. If he overcame Yetzirah, fine. If not, he should study Torah. If he won over him, if he vanquished him, fine. If not, he should read Kriya Shema. If he wants the battle, good. If not, he should remember the day of death. So you see from there that study of Torah is the way to battle, but it's not the final way. There are better ways. There are more effective ways. Like what? Like Kriya Shema or Yom HaMisa, which are, that he understands it to mean, the study of Musa. That's the last resort. So Reb Chaim argued that studying Musar should be used only if the other ways are ineffective. This order of the Gemara, try this, right? And then, why? Because Musar, he said, is like castor oil. For sick people, it is healing. But for the hale, it's sickening. That's what he said. In other words, try another element that comes first. If it doesn't work, it means that you're sick. So then you take the castor oil. Then you say Krishna and remember the Yom HaMisa. And he says, we at Falashim, I thank God healthy. This is this story of the dialogue between the Bitzel, the Baal Musar, and Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the anti-Musar. And the third story is that he said a drasha, and when the Nitzi found out the purpose of Reb Bitzel's visit in the Lashon, he chided him in rebuke, and he ordered him to leave the city. Short and sweet. This was, I say, all three are true. First was, like I said, the order that I told you. First, he said a speech, and he said that Musar is the real Rafua. It's not a segula like the study of Torah, but this is a Rafua for the Yitzhak. So the Reb Chaim Soloveitchik told him, the yeshiva is not sick. It's not different than a school or a full yeshiva is not sick. Then the Netziv said, then the Bitzel said, yeah, but maybe there are some sick boys in the yeshiva. Fine, the yeshiva generally is healthy, doesn't it? But there are some. So study was to help those boys. So that's when he said, it's a castor oil. That for the sick it's healthy, it's good, but for the healthy, most of the boys are, for the healthy it's awful for them to learn Musar. This was the second part of the debate. And the third one was that the Nitzin, who obviously was out of town where the Bitzel came, or this was 20 years younger than the Nitzin. The Nitzin was born in 1837, and he was born the Nesim was born in 1817, and he was born, at least was born in 1837, and he came back from wherever he was. He found her, he said, what are you doing here, you Muslimic? Get out of your Lashon. But anyways, the Lashon was against Muslim. And therefore, I say furthermore, this visit took place in 1881. When was the Sabbatki Yeshiva founded by the Alter of Sabbatki together with the help of Reb Bitzel, the disappointed guest of Elohim, in 1882? Because of what happened in Elohim, you realize Musar is not going to have to enter the Yeshiva world through Elohim. We have to build our own Yeshiva. Because of that episode, the Sabbatki Yeshiva was built as an antithesis to the Lashon. And Sabbatki saw itself as the antidote that the Lashon was the ailment. It is no wonder that when the Lashon closed, Sabbatki was relieved. The anti-Musar bastion had crumbled, and the Torah would now be taught in collusion with Musar, and Judaism would be saved. Sabbatki didn't mourn the closure of Elohim, it was relieved. Thank you.
Kamenetsky has agreed to take questions from the audience.
We glossed over the influence of the outside influence of whether a secular study is being taught. The next question is two ways. Does the fact that the yeshiva closed and the other yeshivas in the area were not forced to close, perhaps that proves that the Nitzin closed down because of the family squabble? Or on the other hand, I'll ask the question, why the other shoe is not after clothes? If sexual studies, if he's done with sexual studies, what is such a bad thing? Why the other shoe is not after clothes?
You mean why the government wasn't after the other yeshivas,
yes,
which also didn't have secular studies?
Correct.
Why did they pick Kalosha? If we're going into a broad subject, but when Reb Chaim Soloveitchik said that Kalosha is all healthy, he was absolutely wrong. Because in the Lashon itself, there were a lot of Talmidim who were secretly outside subjects and study outside subjects. As a matter of fact, Bialik and Nachman Bialik, who came from Zhytomyr to study in the Lashon, he came around 1889. So in the Lashon, in Zhytomyr, his hometown, he had heard that the Lashon is a stepping stone to Berlin. And in other words, he thought coming to the Lashon, not to learn Torah so much, but to learn other studies, and in that way he becomes educated in outside studies. And he writes in his memoirs that when he came to Malosha, he started only learning the Torah. Why? Because the ones that were studying down inside, it was all a secret. They put that in the stranger. So the Yalik writes that he got into learning, and he got so much into learning, I have to tell you, that when you read this, you find that nowadays you would say Hunisraf in Balazan, and then he wrote a letter to his friends, I'm a different Chaim Nachman, I struggle all these things, I see for myself banging the future in Rabbonis. He became, but then he regressed and he returned to his own self. Anyways, There was a maskimi in Balazan, and the son of the Nitziv. The Nitziv had a son who was born in 1880, in his old age. He was 12 years old when Balazan closed down. Reb Meir Berlin, who changed his name to Bar Ilan. Bar Ilan University is named for the son of the Nitziv, Reb Meir Berlin. So he writes in his book, From Balazan to Jerusalem, he has a book from Jerusalem. So he writes, he says, as long as there's only outside forces who want to bring the secular studies into the yeshiva, there was no problem. And manage it, they bribe this official, whatever, they got away with it. But when students from within were undermining the yeshiva, so it was hopeless. And that's why the other yeshiva didn't suffer the persecution of the Russian government, and the Belarusian did. But in the improvement issue, I quote new documents that were brought to light, Russian government documents. You know, we Jews have our own attitude why Belarusian was closed. We have this letter and we have that letter. But what if the Goyim closed the village? What did they have in mind? We don't know. We didn't know. So I want to tell you that the Goyim aren't as stupid as they look. The Goyim has a reason. And the official documents that were uncovered recently, after my first book, my unimproved edition was out, until a new one tells a new story altogether. But you'll have to read my improved edition. It's only, I told Rabbi Yashiv, I don't sell it in America. I'll tell you the truth. When I told him, I was sitting there with his son, with my son, his grandson was there. I met him many times after the Yisrael, so he got to know me. So I said, the Rav doesn't have to mix in, because I'll be selling it only in America. So the Gdelim over there, they never came. So I saw from his body language that he was like taken aback. And my son noticed it too, and walked back. Why? Because he's the God of America too. What am I telling you? But since I said I only sell it in America, I'm only selling it in America. Yes?
My wife said that part of the closer at the end and closer to the fact of the Torah. But is there also more of a perspective on whether the yeshiva stresses the positive aspects of life?
Whether what?
Or whether yeshiva should stress the joy of Torah, the joy of life, as opposed to stressing the
intellectual
side of ourselves. Is that also part of the stress?
That's part of the Derech HaMusar. Derech HaMusar is that you have to build up the person, not only make it knowledgeable. You have to develop his personality. This is the chiddush of the Musa movement. And this, I hope, is what the others have recommended, that the way he viewed Yiddishkeit before he became a Talmud is the opposite of Yiddishkeit. In other words, those that say Yiddishkeit just as a set of rules and knowledge and all that, but not the development of the person as such. So they don't have the real tzura, the real tzura of Torah. This is exactly what the Alter Sabbath commands. This is a chiddush of the Muslim movement. And this was the only way the Muslim was able to counteract the modern influences by showing that this person not only is an observant Jew or a knowledgeable Jew, but he's a higher person. A higher person than the general, than let's say the one who isn't involved in Torah. And this was a very important facet of the Muslim movement. Yes.
Is it possible I can make a point? And if you've ever heard anything like this, my great uncle is an Einikul of the Vilna Gaon. And I once asked him, that it doesn't make sense, there's so much machlekes between the Hasidim and by the Lipsh of God. What's going on? See, he explained to me the same problem the Vilna Gaon had with the Hasidim, he would also have with the Muslim movement. And the reason being is he said that by the Muslim movement and by the Hasidus, before they even start, there's an alternative motive of about Musa. You know, you're learning out the Pesukim in a certain way to try and fit, to better yourself, and learning as well that influences the way you learn. So you learn the Musa Sforim, and the way you learn the Musa Sforim will influence the way you learn the Gemara. And my grandfather said this was one of the big problems that the Vilna Gaon had. Could it be said that they held the same view and the Machlekes?
You mean the study of Musa can affect the type of study of Torah?
It affects the way you study the Talmud. It affects the way you study. And one of the reasonings, he said, it wasn't a Stamazoy Machlekes. He didn't want the Torah, my great uncle said, he didn't want the Torah to be learnt in any other way apart from the Torah itself. No Musa, no Hasidus, straight Yashar.
I'll tell you, Torah, just learning the Torah itself, I don't see why it should be affected by, you can just say, the time spent in learning Musar or in trying to develop your personality, you could have spent that time reading more, learning more Torah. But so far as the type of learning of Torah, I don't see why the learning of the Musar should affect it. I mean, certainly, when they started learning Musar, they would say, please, let's learn it with the stylus and the emotion and all that, but that doesn't have to affect the learning of Shemshad HaSapov with emotion and all that. It could be the chassidus, they try to say that the learning of Shemshad HaSapov really doesn't bring you closer to God. And that would be something that Vilna Gaon would fight against more than the study of Muslim. Yes.
You mentioned that it's twice that the book was banned by one who weren't very familiar with you or the book. I banned it. Can you elaborate on what that tells us about these famous bans?
The
book was banned by one who weren't very familiar with you or your book.
Right. Well,
what does that tell you and us about the nature of these bans?
Well, I'll tell you, because of the I said, he said, my father would hold back from visiting the Moshe Feinstein. Why? If he had a question or something to discuss it, fine. But just as a visit, my father liked to schmooze with people, liked to visit people, but he wouldn't visit the Moshe Feinstein. Why? Because Moshe Feinstein was very, very, a bit masnik. He didn't waste a minute from learning. So he felt, he comes in just to speak to him, he's wasting his time from learning. Now, I want to tell you that Rabbi Yashiv is a very big masnik. When people come to him, so between person to person, gavra to gavra, he's looking at the sefer. I never went to visit Rabbi Yashiv, I never got to know him. Until after I had a problem. So he didn't know me, he didn't know who I was. So when I saw Izhilikas, you know, Izhilikas means troublemakers, when they came to tell him that Nelson Kamenetsky wrote a book, he wrote this, he wrote that, and so on, he didn't know what Nelson Kamenetsky was. So he imagined it. The way they described the book that I wrote, he probably figured I must be Yom Kippur, and I must do a college Shabbos. The way they described what my book says. So I said, all right, so he signed the letter that they dropped in. But after all that, and after it was too late already, so that's how I went to visit him, I went to meet him, I visited him many times, and I got close to him. And after that, if he would have known me before, so when they came first, he would have said, let me call him up and ask him what he says in the book. But when I came to visit him the first time, which was like 3/4 of a year, after the first time I saw him was Elul. The Issa came out in Teves, and 3/4 of a year Elul, if you recall, Rabbi Yashiv became very sick. He was sick at the hospital in an emergency. They brought him surgery in the United States. So I saw him 2 days before he got sick. I hope I didn't make him sick. So I saw him then, and the first time I met him, and since then, I've seen many times.
Why was the
veil
retracted?
What's that?
Why was the veil retracted?
Who said it was retracted?
Why wasn't it?
Why wasn't it? It's easier to make a veil than to retract it. I never asked him to retract it. What I asked him to just is to give me a letter that the new book, the improved book, which I had people read and agree that it's been improved, that should have a letter from him that it should be judged on its own merits. Which, not that I'm asking his approval, just, and he promised he would give it, but then he backed off. He said the first ones that came to make trouble, they'll say it's no good, and these new people are going to say it is good. I just don't have the strength to involve myself. So I said, but one thing, if anybody comes to complain about my book, tell him that you have to call in Nelson Kamenetsky to sit there while they're complaining. I said, yeah, but that you're right. And after he told me that, his grandson used to attend all the stanza when people come to speak to his grandfather. So after that, I wrote out a letter to all the signatories, and I said, this is what Rabbi Yashiv said. I said, I spent time and money in order to improve the book, even though Rav Shambel said it's kosher, even though Rav Zalayevsky wrote to Rabbi Yashiv, so I see no justification whatsoever. I said, you know, to ask for this book, but because you, signatory, gave an issue, I improved it, and so on. And I want to tell you what Rabbi Yashiv said. If anybody comes to complain, he's going to call me in. So I want you to do the same. And I handed this letter to each one of the signatories. I couldn't hand it to Rabbi Wolven, who had passed away in the interim. But to the others, I gave the letter. And I showed it first to the grandson of Rabbi Yashiv while he stands there, to see if I'm writing, if I understood his grandfather correctly. So now in the letter I write that these Zhilikas came running to Rabbi Yashiv before the book even came out, before the improved. They wanted to dance from the improved book. I'm saying there's nothing to dance, it doesn't exist yet.
So I wrote it to the letter here. But they came running to him, and they read it to Rabbi Yashin, and he is dachai, some bishnei adayin. He expelled him. But it didn't come after the book is written. I want you to call me in. And that's it. And I went to give this letter to Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky, who is the son-in-law of Rabbi Yashin. He told me, Rabbi Nosson, about me, you don't have to worry. Because I don't sign anything unless my father and my bell speak to
Based on the shot, there's no shlichus by me. Did Rav Chaim mouth his son as a result of it, his son died? That's what it sounded like from the book, and I read it several times.
I didn't write the shach.
What?
I didn't write anything about the shach.
I'm sorry.
He just said about Rav Chaim mouth his son and?
And the son died.
Could be. I have to read the book again. But I know that after that he was afraid to hold the baby while it was being mouthed. Yes.
I asked this question with apologies in advance in case it's inappropriate, but does improved mean, obviously there are things that the Rav added to the book, but does it also mean there are things that are missing because of objections that might have been...
The things that were objected to, I explain better. That's what I explain things better. Maybe I change the language. Let's say people misread the word. I can call to someone. Someone describes the difference between the Netziv and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. So I wrote the perceived difference. That the Netziv was tough, and he was autocratic, and Rav Chaim was friendly and all that. So I say the perceived difference. But the people who read the book don't know what the word perceived. As a matter of fact, one of the people that came to Rabbi Yashin to come out against my book told my brother-in-law that he wasn't able to read the book without a dictionary on the side. Anyway, so I explained better what I mean by perceived. There's something that I wrote, some student didn't look at it that way. Now there is one thing that I omitted. That's for a different reason. Because that person stopped speaking to me. The person that told me that story stopped speaking to me after the bank came out against me. So I didn't want to honor him by putting something that he told me in the book. So I admitted it. But I have in the improved edition, I have an appendix which lists all the pages that were changed and the nature of the change. So there's only one omission. That the omission is pertaining to Rabban Kotler, and that I write about Rabban Kotler when somebody used to ask in the middle of a shiur. So I used to wipe the floor with him. Like you would say, you're speaking like a drunk Turk, or you got to go back to kindergarten. He would say, so one time he was speaking in England, and somebody interrupted his shiur, somebody with a red beard. So he asked one question, another question. And finally, the Rabban said, be quiet, Tava Duma. It's very interesting. Now, I was criticized. How do I write such things that he spoke to people so freshly? Or Rav Lezer Goyim used to say, you speak like a shaykh. He used to say, how do I write about it? So I said, who holds more of Gedolim, me or you? You say that then I have to act in the way you like them to act. But this time, this didn't happen one time. This is constantly going on. It wasn't a one-time failure. This is the way he said this year. So you say that you know better. So who holds more of Dolan, me or you? I said what Dolan did is the way, is a valid way of doing things. And you say I have to do it your way. I said, who holds more of Dolan, me or you? Is an answer. So that story I omitted. But the point I brought up is the same. The way he used to speak, like a Turk, like a drunk Turk. And the one the Talmud once asked about him, what do you mean a drunk Turk? He once asked him, I'm poor. So he said like this, somebody's drunk, he doesn't know what he's saying, but we know what he's saying. A Turk knows what he's saying, but we don't understand the language. But if he's a drunk Turk, neither he knows what he's saying, nor do I. Yes,
sir. When can we expect the next volume?
I'll tell you, there's one person here in the audience who can answer that question. And she's upstairs in the Ezra's Nashim. I have to get my wife's permission. I have a lot of material on it. And I hope Be'ezras Hashem. Be'ezras Hashem and Be'ezra Kenegda. Yes.
Two questions. First question, very quick.
Let other people hear the question.
Who's going to be publishing the Rav's book? And second question, perhaps I'm reading, I'm listening a little bit too much into the Rav's work, but when the Rav mentioned that Rav Moshe Sternbach Shlita, that his reading of the Rav's book is his tikkun, is this referring to atonement guitarist or a thing for the Rav Sternbach's banner of the book?
I tell you, when I used the word tikkun, I didn't mean, he never sinned against my book. Right away, as soon as the dodo of people is forbade it, so he said to people, go buy it. Right away, I just use the word tikkun, they say tikkun shavua, so tikkun of shanrabah. I just use, this is the way he spent it, shanrabah night. As far you say think of other books that he banned, I'll tell you, Rav Shlita told me, you know my brother Rav Shmuel Shlita, usually the godly in America, and I took my father's position after my father died. So he didn't retract his approval of the Slifkin book. Now Rabbi Sternbach is against the Slifkin book. So he told me, he says, until the story in the Slifkin book, so you are the Rosh and your brother was the tzaddik. And your brother's the Rosh and you're the tzaddik. Yes. First of all, the Alter Sabbat didn't say everybody's wrong. He said that the Bishwa Salanta was right. And the Bishwa Salanta Samidim were right, he was saying. But you have to realize that Avraham Avinu said everybody's wrong and I'm lying right. Avraham Avinu said that already. When a situation arises, like when the world opened up to Jews, the Jewry had to face a new situation. You have to have people who would be revolutionaries and say the old way will be ineffective now. Like why don't you speak about the Chofetz Chaim, the Chofetz Chaim himself? You should say, how can I say the Chofetz Chaim was not right about Moshe? Chofetz Chaim was such a big tzaddik and so on and so forth. But the Bali Moshe considered him, he was truly a big tzaddik. But this was the old world for the new. He didn't go along with the changes, and he had to go along with the changes. Of course, nowadays we have a whole society, a whole Haredi society, that just refuses to look at the outside world. Okay, maybe it's a big enough world that it exists by itself. But in Lithuania, that wasn't the situation. People couldn't just block out the world from themselves. They had to live within the world. And in order to live within a different type of world, a different kind of society, you had to have people who would say, this is the right way, and insist that their way was right. That's Abraham Avinu.
The
fighting
between different movements in the
you obviously notice that I made promises to you. Now, if you ask me, was the contenders, the fact that there was a fight between, was it promise or anger? Was it good? So I say, of course, it would have been good if everybody would have been promiser. Yeah. But I don't say that the fight itself was good. But I will say that there were certain people who didn't see the light of Musr. They didn't see the light, they didn't see the importance of Musr. And they found on the contrary. Maybe it's wasteful of time. And they shouldn't have Musr. What do you mean is what? But I'm saying that the people who I agree with the people who realized that it was important, not only important, but it was vital. Vital for the continuation of Yiddish.
Back to the closing of Allah. Rav mentioned that there were different camps between the yeshiva supporting there was sort of a Chaim Soloveitchik versus a Chaim Berlin to take over the yeshiva. Between a Chaim Soloveitchik and a Chaim Berlin, between themselves and their own relationship, was there peace between them? And depending on, and along with that answer, what attempts were made during the whole Sitzuf to really keep the yeshiva together?
I'll tell you, you're touching on a point which I touched on in the old book and in the improved edition because of the release of the government papers. I wrote in my book that there's no evidence whatsoever that Reb Chaim Soloveitchik himself was personally involved in the machlokas. Now, according to the government papers, they say there, I'm afraid I have to, in order to answer your question, I have to tell you what the thrust of the papers are. The thrust of the papers, the reason why the Russians called the yeshiva was because of the anarchy within the yeshiva. They were afraid that this will spawn anarchists. And the Russian government was afraid, who knows what they'll do now with the Tsar. They were afraid of the revolution. They had the revolution constantly against the whole Russian system. So they were afraid. And they write in there that if there'd be another Jewish group that would take over the yeshiva from Berlin and Soloveitchik, they'd give the yeshiva. They only use the secular studies as an excuse. In the old book, I prove it must have been. I don't understand it. Because they wanted the yeshiva to have 9 hours of secular studies and 3 hours of Gemara. It wasn't a question of bringing in 3 hours of secular studies and 9 hours of Gemara, where the yeshiva might have gone along. That's what I mean, yeshiva with secular studies. They wanted to change it from a yeshiva into a university with Jewish studies. Of course it couldn't be accepted. So this whole thing that's supposed because of the Midrash, that if you know the facts of time, it couldn't be because of that. The Russians, they wanted to close it, that's what it was. Why? I didn't know until I saw the government papers. The government papers say, because of the anarchy going on. So they, in those papers, they do accuse Chaim Soloveitchik of being involved, but in an underhand way, in a sly way, and all that. But I say, the official must have been told that, but some of the students were the ones who Chaim Soloveitchik to become the Rosh Yeshiva, appointed by the government. So therefore he said, no, he's behind it, he's making himself. The Chaim Soloveitchik is the one who made sure that the Estrin a little over given back and had his windows broken. The Chaim Soloveitchik was 20 years younger than the Chaim Berlin, and he was an unambitious person altogether. He was an ambitious person altogether. And 20 years younger, he certainly wouldn't have been involved. Maybe he should have spoken up, but I wanted Chaim Berlin to be the Rosh Yeshiva. But he was also indecisive of Chaim Soloveitchik. So he involved himself in learning it, but the students who wanted him to be, not the Chaim Berlin, are the ones who led the machlokas. There's no evidence whatsoever there between them. As a matter of fact, Chaim Berlin on Simchas Torah picked up Chaim Soloveitchik and he told everybody, you're dancing with the Torah Shebichsav, I'm dancing with the Torah Shebalpeh. He knew Chaim Soloveitchik is... I thank you very much. Thank you. Yes or no?